It is no wonder that the writers of the 19th century look upon society as an artificial creation of the legislator's genius. This idea, the fruit of classical education, has taken possession of all the intellectuals and famous writers of our country. To these intellectuals and writers, the relationship between persons and the legislator appears to be the same as the relationship between the clay and the potter. Moreover, even where they have consented to recognize a principle of action in the heart of man, and a principle of discernment in man's intellect, they have considered these gifts from God to be fatal gifts. They have thought that persons under the impulse of these two gifts would fatally tend to ruin themselves. They assume that if the legislators left persons free to follow their own inclinations, they would arrive at atheism instead of religion, ignorance instead of knowledge, poverty instead of production and exchange. According to these writers, it is indeed fortunate that heaven has bestowed upon certain men, governors and legislators, the exact opposite inclinations, not only for their own sake, but also for the sake of the rest of the world. While mankind tends toward evil, the legislators yearn for good. While mankind advances toward darkness, the legislators aspire for enlightenment. While mankind is drawn toward vice, the legislators are attracted toward virtue. Since they have decided that this is the true state of affairs, they then demand the use of force in order to substitute their own inclinations for those of the human race. Open at random any book on philosophy, politics, or history, and you will probably see how deeply rooted in our country is this idea, the child of classical studies, the mother of socialism. In all of them, you will probably find this idea that mankind is merely inert matter, receiving life, organization, morality, and prosperity from the power of the state. And even worse, it will be stated that mankind tends toward degeneration and is stopped from this downward course only by the mysterious hand of the legislator. Conventional classical thought everywhere says that behind passive society there is a concealed power called law or legislator, or called by some other terminology that designates some unnamed person or persons of undisputed influence and authority, which moves, controls, benefits, and improves mankind. Let us first consider a quotation from Bossuet, tutor to the Dauphin in the court of Louis XIV. One of the things most strongly impressed, by whom? Upon the minds of the Egyptians, was patriotism. No one was permitted to be useless to the state. The law assigned to each one his work, which was handed down from father to son. No one was permitted to have two professions, nor could a person change from one job to another. But there was one task to which all were forced to conform, the study of the laws and of wisdom. Ignorance of religion and of the political regulations of the country was not excused under any circumstances. Moreover, each occupation was assigned, by whom, to a certain district. Among the good laws, one of the best was that everyone was trained. By whom? To obey them. As a result of this, Egypt was filled with wonderful inventions, and nothing was neglected that could make life easy and quiet. Thus, according to Bossuet, persons derive nothing from themselves. Patriotism, prosperity, inventions, husbandry, science, all of these are given to the people by the operation of the laws, the rulers. All that the people have to do is to bow to leadership. Bossuet carries this idea of the state as the source of all progress, even so far as to defend the Egyptians against the charge that they rejected wrestling and music. He said, "How is that possible? These arts were invented by Trismegistus, who was alleged to have been chancellor to the Egyptian god Osiris." And again, among the Persians, Bossuet claims that all comes from above. Quote, "One of the first responsibilities of the prince was to encourage agriculture. Just as there were offices established for the regulation of armies, just so were there offices for the direction of farm work. The Persian people were inspired with an overwhelming respect for royal authority." End of quote. And according to Bossuet, the Greek people, although exceedingly intelligent, had no sense of personal responsibility. Like dogs and horses, they themselves could not have invented the most simple games. Quote, "The Greeks, naturally intelligent and courageous, had been early cultivated by the kings and settlers who had come from Egypt. From these Egyptian rulers, the Greek people had learned bodily exercises, foot races, and horse and chariot races. But the best thing that the Egyptians had taught the Greeks was to become docile and to permit themselves to be formed by the law for the public good. End of quote. It cannot be disputed that these classical theories, advanced by these latter-day teachers, writers, legislators, economists, and philosophers, held that everything came to the people from a source outside themselves. As another example, take Fenelon, archbishop, author, and instructor to the Duke of Burgundy. He was a witness to the power of Louis XIV. This, plus the fact that he was nurtured in the classical studies and the admiration of antiquity, naturally caused Fenelon to accept the idea that mankind should be passive, that the misfortunes and the prosperity, vices and virtues of people are caused by the external influence exercised upon them by the law and the legislators. Thus, in his Utopia of Saluntum, he puts men, with all their interests, faculties, desires, and possessions, under the absolute discretion of the legislator. Whatever the issue may be, persons do not decide it for themselves. The prince decides for them. The prince is depicted as the soul of this shapeless mass of people who form the nation. In the prince resides the thought, the foresight, all progress, and the principle of all organization. Thus, all responsibility rests with him. The whole of the 10th book of Fenelon's Telemachus proves this. I refer the reader to it, and content myself with quoting at random from this celebrated work to which, in every other respect, I am the first to pay homage. With the amazing credulity which is typical of the classicists, Fenelon ignores the authority of reason and facts when he attributes the general happiness of the Egyptians not to their own wisdom, but to the wisdom of their kings. He writes, "We could not turn our eyes to either shore without seeing rich towns and country estates most agreeably located, fields never fallowed, covered with golden crops every year, meadows full of flocks, workers bending under the weight of the fruit which the earth lavished upon its cultivators, shepherds who made the echoes resound with the soft notes from their pipes and flutes. Happy," said Mentor, "is the people governed by a wise king." Later, Mentor desired that I observe the contentment and abundance which covered all Egypt, where 22,000 cities could be counted. He admired the good police regulations in the cities, the justice rendered in favor of the poor against the rich, the sound education of the children in obedience, labor, sobriety, and the love of the arts and letters, the exactness with which all religious ceremonies were performed, the unselfishness, the high regard for honor, the faithfulness to men, and the fear of the gods, which every father taught his children. He never stopped admiring the prosperity of the country. "Happy," said he, "is the people ruled by a wise king in such a manner." Fenelon's idea on Crete is even more alluring. Mentor is made to say, "All that you see in this wonderful island results from the laws of Minos. The education which he ordained for the children makes their bodies strong and robust. From the very beginning, one accustoms the children to a life of frugality and labor, because one assumes that all pleasures of the senses weaken both body and mind. Thus, one allows them no pleasure except that of becoming invincible by virtue and of acquiring glory. Here, one punishes three vices that go unpunished among other people: ingratitude, hypocrisy, and greed. There is no need to punish persons for pomp and dissipation, for they are unknown in Crete. No costly furniture, no magnificent clothing, no delicious feasts, no gilded palaces are permitted." Thus does Mentor prepare his student to mold and to manipulate, doubtless with the best of intentions, the people of Ithaca. And to convince the student of the wisdom of these ideas, Mentor recites to him the example of Saluntum. It is from this sort of philosophy that we receive our first political ideas. We are taught to treat persons much as an instructor in agriculture teaches farmers to prepare and tend the soil. Now, listen to great Montesquieu on the same subject. "To maintain the spirit of commerce, it is necessary that all the laws must favor it. These laws, by proportionately dividing up the fortunes as they are made in commerce, should provide every poor citizen with sufficiently easy circumstances to enable him to work like the others. These same laws should put every rich citizen in such lowered circumstances as to force him to work in order to keep or to gain. End of quote. Thus the laws are to dispose of all fortunes. Back to Montesquieu. Although real equality is the soul of the state in a democracy, yet this is so difficult to establish that an extreme precision in this matter would not always be desirable. It is sufficient that here be established a census to reduce or fix these differences in wealth within a certain limit. After this is done, it remains for specific laws to equalize inequality by imposing burdens upon the rich and granting relief to the poor. End of quote. Here again we find the idea of equalizing fortunes by law, by force. Back to Montesquieu. In Greece, there were two kinds of republics. One, Sparta, was military. The other, Athens, was commercial. In the former, it was desired that the citizens be idle. In the latter, love of labor was encouraged. Note the marvelous genius of these legislators. By debasing all established customs, by mixing the usual concepts of all virtues, they knew in advance that the world would admire their wisdom. Lycurgus gave stability to his city of Sparta by combining petty thievery with the soul of justice, by combining the most complete bondage with the most extreme liberty, by combining the most atrocious beliefs with the greatest moderation. He appeared to deprive his city of all its resources, arts, commerce, money, and defenses. In Sparta, ambition went without the hope of material reward. Natural affection found no outlet because a man was neither son, husband, nor father. Even chastity was no longer considered becoming. By this road, Lycurgus led Sparta on to greatness and glory. This boldness, which was to be found in the institutions of Greece, has been repeated in the midst of the degeneracy and corruption of our modern times. An occasional honest legislator has molded a people in whom integrity appears as natural as courage in the Spartans. Mr. William Penn, for example, is a true Lycurgus. Even though Mr. Penn had peace as his objective, while Lycurgus had war as his objective, they resemble each other in that their moral prestige over free men allowed them to overcome prejudices, to subdue passions, and to lead their respective peoples into new paths. The country of Paraguay furnishes us with another example of a people who, for their own good, are molded by their legislators. Now it is true that if one considers the sheer pleasure of commanding to be the greatest joy in life, he contemplates a crime against society. It will, however, always be a noble ideal to govern men in a manner that will make them happier. Those who desire to establish similar institutions must do as follows. Establish common ownership of property, as in the Republic of Plato. Revere the gods, as Plato commanded. Prevent foreigners from mingling with the people in order to preserve the customs. Let the state, instead of the citizens, establish commerce. The legislators should supply arts instead of luxuries. They should satisfy needs instead of desires. End of quote. Those who are subject to vulgar infatuation may exclaim, Montesquieu has said this, so it's magnificent, it's sublime. As for me, I have the courage of my own opinion. I say, what? You have the nerve to call that fine? It is frightful. It is abominable. These random selections from the writings of Montesquieu show that he considers persons, liberties, property, mankind itself, to be nothing but materials for legislators to exercise their wisdom upon. Now let us examine Rousseau on this subject. This writer on public affairs is the supreme authority of the Democrats. And although he bases the social structure upon the will of the people, he has, to a greater extent than anyone else, completely accepted the theory of the total inertness of mankind in the presence of the legislators. He wrote, "If it is true that a great prince is rare, then is it not true that a great legislator is even more rare? The prince has only to follow the pattern that the legislator creates. The legislator is the mechanic who invents the machine. The prince is merely the workman who sets it in motion." End of quote. And what part do persons play in all this? They are merely the machine that is set in motion. In fact, are they not merely considered to be the raw material of which the machine is made? Thus, the same relationship exists between the legislator and the prince as exists between the agricultural expert and the farmer. And the relationship between the prince and his subjects is the same as that between the farmer and his land. How high above mankind, then, has this writer on public affairs been placed? Rousseau rules over legislators themselves and teaches them their trade in these imperious terms. Would you give stability to the state? Then bring the extremes as closely together as possible. Tolerate neither wealthy persons nor beggars. If the soil is poor or barren, or the country too small for its inhabitants, then turn to industry and arts, and trade these products for the foods that you need. On a fertile soil, if you are short of inhabitants, devote all your attention to agriculture, because this multiplies people. Banish the arts, because they only serve to depopulate the nation. If you have extensive and accessible coastlines, then cover the sea with merchant ships. You will have a brilliant but short existence. If your seas wash only inaccessible cliffs, let the people be barbarous and eat fish. They will live more quietly, perhaps better, and most certainly they will live more happily. In short, and in addition to the maxims that are common to all, every people has its own particular circumstances, and this fact in itself will cause legislation appropriate to the circumstances. This is the reason why the Hebrews formerly, and more recently the Arabs, had religion as their principal objective. The objective of the Athenians was literature, of Carthage and Tyre, commerce, of Rhodes, naval affairs, of Sparta, war, and of Rome, virtue. The author of The Spirit of Laws has shown by what art the legislator should direct his institutions toward each of these objectives. But suppose that the legislator mistakes his proper objective and acts on a principle different from that indicated by the nature of things. Suppose that the selected principle sometimes creates slavery and sometimes liberty, sometimes wealth and sometimes population, sometimes peace and sometimes conquest. This confusion of objective will slowly enfeeble the law and impair the Constitution. The state will be subjected to ceaseless agitations until it is destroyed or changed, and invincible nature regains her empire. End of quote. But if nature is insufficiently invincible to regain its empire, why does not Rousseau admit that it did not need the legislator to gain it in the first place? Why does he not see that men, by obeying their own instincts, would turn to farming on fertile soil and to commerce on an extensive and easily accessible coast, without the interference of a Lycurgus or a Solon or a Rousseau, who might easily be mistaken? Be that as it may, Rousseau invests the creators, organizers, directors, legislators, and controllers of society with a terrible responsibility. He is, therefore, most exacting with them, as follows. He who would dare to undertake the political creation of a people ought to believe that he can, in a manner of speaking, transform human nature, transform each individual, who by himself is a solitary and perfect whole, into a mere part of a greater whole from which the individual will henceforth receive his life and being. Thus, the person who would undertake the political creation of a people should believe in his ability to alter man's constitution, to strengthen it, to substitute for the physical and independent existence received from nature, an existence which is partial and moral. In short, the would-be creator of political man must remove man's own forces and endow him with others that are naturally alien to him. End of quote. Poor human nature! What would become of a person's dignity if it were entrusted to the followers of Rousseau? Now, let us examine Raynal on this subject of mankind being molded by the legislator. He writes, "The legislator must first consider the climate, the air, and the soil. The resources at his disposal determine his duties. He must first consider his locality. A population living on maritime shores must have laws designed for navigation. If it is an island settlement, the legislator must make his plans according to the nature and fertility of the soil. It is especially in the distribution of property that the genius of the legislator will be found. As a general rule, when a new colony is established in any country, sufficient land should be given to each man to support his family. On an uncultivated island that you are populating with children, you need do nothing but let the seeds of truth germinate along with the development of reason. But when you resettle a nation with a past into a new country, the skill of the legislator rests in the policy of permitting the people to retain no injurious opinions and customs which can possibly be cured and corrected. If you desire to prevent these opinions and customs from becoming permanent, you will secure the second generation by a general system of public education for the children. A prince or a legislator should never establish a colony without first arranging to send wise men along to instruct the youth. In a new colony, ample opportunity is open to the careful legislator who desires to purify the customs and manners of the people. If he has virtue and genius, the land and the people at his disposal will inspire his soul with a plan for society. A writer can only vaguely trace the plan in advance, because it is necessarily subject to the instability of all hypotheses. The problem has many forms, complications, and circumstances that are difficult to foresee and settle in detail. Reynald's instruction to the legislators on how to manage people may be compared to a professor of agriculture lecturing his students, thusly. The climate is the first rule for the farmer. His resources determine his procedure. He must first consider his locality. If his soil is clay, he must do so and so. If his soil is sand, he must act in another manner. Every facility is open to the farmer who wishes to clear and improve his soil. If he is skillful enough, the manure at his disposal will suggest to him a plan of operation. A professor can only vaguely trace this plan in advance, because it is necessarily subject to the instability of all hypotheses. The problem has many forms, complications, and circumstances that are difficult to foresee and settle in detail. Oh, sublime writers, please remember sometimes that this clay, this sand, and this manure which you so arbitrarily dispose of are men. They are your equals. They are intelligent and free human beings like yourselves. As you have, they too have received from God the faculty to observe, to plan ahead, to think, and to judge for themselves. Here is my plea on this subject of the law and the legislator. In the passages preceding the one here quoted, my plea has supposed the laws, due to a neglect of security, to be worn out. He continues to address the reader thusly. Under these circumstances, it is obvious that the springs of government are slack. Give them a new tension, and the evil will be cured. Think less of punishing faults, and more of rewarding that which you need. In this manner you will restore to your public the vigor of youth. Because free people have been ignorant of this procedure, they have lost their liberty. But if the evil has made such headway that ordinary governmental procedures are unable to cure it, then resort to an extraordinary tribunal with considerable powers for a short time. The imagination of the citizens needs to be struck a hard blow. In this manner, Mobley continues through 20 volumes. Under the influence of teaching like this, which stems from classical education, there came a time when everyone wished to place himself above mankind in order to arrange, organize, and regulate it in his own way. Next, let us examine Condillac on this subject of the legislators and mankind. My lord, assume the character of Lycurgus or of Solon, and before you finish reading this essay, amuse yourself by giving laws to some savages in America or Africa. Confine these nomads to fixed dwellings, teach them to tend flocks, attempt to develop the social consciousness that nature has planted in them, force them to begin to practice the duties of humanity, use punishment to cause sensual pleasures to become distasteful to them. Then you will see that every point of your legislation will cause these savages to lose a vice and to gain a virtue. All people have had laws, but few people have been happy. Why is this so? Because the legislators themselves have almost always been ignorant of the purpose of society, which is uniting of families by a common interest. Impartiality in law consists of two things: the establishing of equality in wealth and equality in dignity among the citizens. As the laws establish greater equality, they become proportionately more precarious to every citizen. When all men are equal in wealth and dignity, and when the laws leave no hope of disturbing this equality, how can men then be agitated by greed, ambition, dissipation, idleness, sloth, envy, hatred, or jealousy? What you have learned about the Republic of Sparta should enlighten you on this question. No other state has ever had laws more in accord with the order of nature, of equality. End of quote. Actually, it is not strange that during the 17th and 18th centuries the human race was regarded as inert matter, ready to receive everything, form, face, energy, movement, life, from a great prince or great legislator or a great genius. These centuries were nourished on the study of antiquity, and antiquity presents everywhere, in Egypt, Persia, Greece, Rome, the spectacle of a few men molding mankind according to their whims, thanks to the prestige of force and fraud. But this does not prove that this situation is desirable. It proves only that since men and society are capable of improvement, it is naturally to be expected that error, ignorance, despotism, slavery, and superstition should be greatest towards the origins of history. The writers quoted above were not in error when they found ancient institutions to be such, but they were in error when they offered them for the admiration and imitation of future generations. Uncritical and childish conformists, they took for granted the grandeur, dignity, morality, and happiness of the artificial societies of the ancient world. They did not understand that knowledge appears and grows with the passage of time, and that in proportion to this growth of knowledge, might takes the side of right, and society regains possession of itself. Actually, what is the political struggle that we witness? It is the instinctive struggle of all people toward liberty. And what is this liberty, whose very name makes the heart beat faster and shakes the world? Is it not the union of all liberties? Liberty of conscience, of education, of association, of the press, of travel, of labor, of trade? In short, is not liberty the freedom of every person to make full use of his faculties, so long as he does not harm other persons while doing so? Is not liberty the destruction of all despotism, including, of course, legal despotism? Finally, is not liberty the restricting of the law only to its rational sphere of organizing the right of the individual to lawful self-defense, of punishing injustice? It must be admitted that the tendency of the human race toward liberty is largely thwarted, especially in France. This is greatly due to a fatal desire, learned from the teachings of antiquity, that our writers on public affairs have in common. The desire to set themselves above mankind in order to arrange, organize, and regulate it according to their fancy. While society is struggling toward liberty, these famous men who put themselves at its head are filled with the spirit of the 17th and 18th centuries. They think only of subjecting mankind to the philanthropic tyranny of their own social inventions. Like Rousseau, they desire to force mankind docilely to bear this yoke of the public welfare that they have dreamed up in their own imaginations. This was especially true in 1789. No sooner was the old regime destroyed than society was subjected to still other artificial arrangements, always starting from the same point, the omnipotence of the law. Listen to the ideas of a few of the writers and politicians during that period. Saint-Just: the legislator commands the future. It is for him to will the good of mankind. It is for him to make men what he wills them to be. Robespierre: the function of government is to direct the physical and moral powers of the nation toward the end for which the commonwealth has come into being. Billaud Varennes: a people who are to be returned to liberty must be formed anew. A strong force and vigorous action are necessary to destroy old prejudices, to change old customs, to correct depraved affections, to restrict superfluous wants, and to destroy ingrained vices. Citizens, the inflexible austerity of Lycurgus created the firm foundation of the Spartan Republic. The weak and trusting character of Solon plunged Athens into slavery. This parallel embraces the whole science of government. Le Pelletier: considering the extent of human degradation, I am convinced that it is necessary to effect a total regeneration and, if I may so express myself, of creating a new people. Again, it is claimed that persons are nothing but raw material. It is not for them to will their own improvement. They are incapable of it. According to Saint-Just, only the legislator is capable of doing this. Persons are merely to be what the legislator wills them to be. According to Robespierre, who copies Rousseau literally, the legislator begins by decreeing the end for which the commonwealth has come into being. Once this is determined, the government has only to direct the physical and moral forces of the nation toward that end. Meanwhile, the inhabitants of the nation are to remain completely passive. And according to the teachings of Billaud Varennes, the people should have no prejudices, no affections, and no desires except those authorized by the legislator. He even goes so far as to say that the inflexible austerity of one man is the foundation of a republic. In cases where the alleged evil is so great that ordinary governmental procedures cannot cure it, Mably recommends a dictatorship to promote virtue. resort, he says, to an extraordinary tribunal with considerable powers for a short time. The imagination of the citizens needs to be struck a hard blow. This doctrine has not been forgotten. Listen to Robespierre. The principle of the republican government is virtue, and the means required to establish virtue is terror. In our country, we desire to substitute morality for selfishness, honesty for honor, principles for customs, duties for manners, the empire of reason for the tyranny of fashion, contempt of vice for contempt of poverty, pride for insolence, greatness of soul for vanity, love of glory for love of money, good people for good companions, merit for intrigue, genius for wit, truth for glitter, the charm of happiness for the boredom of pleasure, the greatness of man for the littleness of the great, a generous, strong, happy people for a good-natured, frivolous, degraded people. In short, we desire to substitute all the virtues and miracles of a republic for all the vices and absurdities of a monarchy. At what a tremendous height above the rest of mankind does Robespierre here place himself. And note the arrogance with which he speaks. He is not content to pray for a great reawakening of the human spirit, nor does he expect such a result from a well-ordered government. No, he himself will remake mankind, and by means of terror. This mass of rotten and contradictory statements is extracted from a discourse by Robespierre in which he aims to explain the principles of morality which ought to guide a revolutionary government. Note that Robespierre's request for dictatorship is not made merely for the purpose of repelling a foreign invasion or putting down the opposing groups. Rather, he wants a dictatorship in order that he may use terror to force upon the country his own principles of morality. He says that this act is only to be a temporary measure preceding a new constitution. But in reality, he desires nothing short of using terror to extinguish from France selfishness, honor, customs, manners, fashion, vanity, love of money, good companionship, intrigue, wit, sensuousness, and poverty. Not until he, Robespierre, shall have accomplished these miracles, as he so rightly calls them, will he permit the law to reign again. Usually, however, these gentlemen, the reformers, the legislators, and the writers on public affairs, do not desire to impose direct despotism on mankind. Oh no, they are too moderate and philanthropic for such direct action. Instead, they turn to the law for this despotism, this absolutism, this omnipotence. They desire only to make the laws. To show the prevalence of this queer idea in France, I would need to copy not only the entire works of Mably, Reynaud, Rousseau, and Fenelon, plus long extracts from Bossuet and Montesquieu, but also the entire proceedings of the convention. I shall do no such thing. I merely refer the reader to them. It is, of course, not at all surprising that this same idea should have greatly appealed to Napoleon. He embraced it ardently and used it with vigor. Like a chemist, Napoleon considered all Europe to be material for his experiments. But in due course, this material reacted against him. At St. Helena, Napoleon, greatly disillusioned, seemed to recognize some initiative in mankind. Recognizing this, he became less hostile to liberty. Nevertheless, this did not prevent him from leaving this lesson to his son in his will. To govern is to increase and spread morality, education, and happiness. After all this, it is hardly necessary to quote the same opinions from Morelli, Babeuf, Owen, Saint-Simon, and Fourier. Here are, however, a few extracts from Louis Blanc's book on the organization of labor. Quote, "In our plan, society receives its momentum from power." End of quote. Now consider this. The impulse behind this momentum is to be supplied by the plan of Louis Blanc. His plan is to be forced upon society. The society referred to is the human race. Thus, the human race is to receive its momentum from Louis Blanc. Now, it will be said that the people are free to accept or reject this plan. Admittedly, people are free to accept or to reject advice from whomever they wish. But this is not the way in which Monsieur Louis Blanc understands the matter. He expects that his plan will be legalized and thus forcibly imposed upon the people by the power of the law. Quote, "In our plan, the state has only to pass labor laws," nothing else, by means of which industrial progress can and must proceed in complete liberty. The state merely places society on an incline. That is all. Then society will slide down this incline by the mere force of things and by the natural workings of the established mechanism. End of quote. But what is this incline that is indicated by Monsieur Louis Blanc? Does it not lead to an abyss? He says no, it leads to happiness. If this is true, then why does not society go there of its own choice? He says, because society does not know what it wants, it must be propelled. What is to propel it? Power. And who is to supply the impulse for this power? Why, the inventor of the machine. In this instance, Monsieur Louis Blanc. We shall never escape from this circle. The idea of passive mankind and the power of the law being used by a great man to propel the people. Once on this incline, will society enjoy some liberty? Monsieur Blanc says, certainly. And what is liberty? Monsieur Louis Blanc. Once and for all, liberty is not only a mere granted right, it is also the power granted to a person to use and to develop his faculties under a reign of justice and under the protection of the law. And this is no pointless distinction. Its meaning is deep and its consequences are difficult to estimate. For once it is agreed that a person, to be truly free, must have the power to use and develop his faculties, then it follows that every person has a claim on society for such education as will permit him to develop himself. It also follows that every person has a claim on society for tools of production, without which human activity cannot be fully effective. Now, by what action can society give to every person the necessary education and the necessary tools of production, if not by the action of the state? Thus again, liberty is power. Of what does this power consist? Of being educated and of being given the tools of production. Who is to give the education and the tools of production? Society, which owes them to everyone. By what action is society to give tools of production to those who do not own them? Why, by the action of the state. And from whom will the state take them? Let the reader answer that question. Let him also notice the direction in which this is taking us. The strange phenomenon of our times, one which will probably astound our descendants, is the doctrine based on this triple hypothesis: the total inertness of mankind, the omnipotence of the law, and the infallibility of the legislator. These three ideas form the sacred symbol of those who proclaim themselves totally democratic. The advocates of this doctrine also profess to be social. So far as they are democratic, they place unlimited faith in mankind. But so far as they are social, they regard mankind as little better than mud. Let us examine this contrast in greater detail. What is the attitude of the democrat when political rights are under discussion? How does he regard the people when a legislator is to be chosen? Ah, then it is claimed that the people have an instinctive wisdom. They are gifted with the finest perception. Their will is always right. The general will cannot err. Voting cannot be too universal. When it is time to vote, apparently the voter is not to be asked for any guarantee of his wisdom. His will and capacity to choose wisely are taken for granted. Can the people be mistaken? Are we not living in an age of enlightenment? What, are the people always to be kept on leashes? Have they not won their rights by great effort and sacrifice? Have they not given ample proof of their intelligence and wisdom? Are they not adults? Are they not capable of judging for themselves? Do they not know what is best for themselves? Is there a class or a man who would be so bold as to set himself above the people and judge and act for them? No, no, the people are and should be free. They desire to manage their own affairs, and they shall do so. But when the legislator is finally elected, ah, then indeed does the tone of his speech undergo a radical change. The people are returned to passiveness, inertness, and unconsciousness. The legislator enters into omnipotence. Now it is for him to initiate, to direct, to propel, and to organize. Mankind has only to submit. The hour of despotism has struck. We now observe this fatal idea. The people who, during the election, were so wise, so moral, and so perfect, now have no tendencies whatever, or if they have any, they are tendencies that lead downward into degradation. But ought not the people be given a little liberty? But Monsieur Considerant has assured us that liberty leads inevitably to monopoly. We understand that liberty means competition. but according to Monsieur Louis Blanc, competition is a system that ruins the businessmen and exterminates the people. It is for this reason that free people are ruined and exterminated in proportion to their degree of freedom. Possibly, Monsieur Louis Blanc should observe the results of competition in, for example, Switzerland, Holland, England, and the United States. Monsieur Louis Blanc also tells us that competition leads to monopoly, and by the same reasoning, he thus informs us that low prices lead to high prices, that competition drives production to destructive activity, that competition drains away the sources of purchasing power, that competition forces an increase in production while at the same time it forces a decrease in consumption. From this, it follows that free people produce for the sake of not consuming, that liberty means oppression and madness among the people, and that Monsieur Louis Blanc absolutely must attend to it. Well, what liberty should the legislators permit people to have? Liberty of conscience? But if this were permitted, we would see the people taking this opportunity to become atheists. Then liberty of education? But parents would pay professors to teach their children immorality and falsehoods. Besides, according to Monsieur Thiers, if education were to be left to national liberty, it would cease to be national, and we would be teaching our children the ideas of the Turks or Hindus. Whereas, thanks to this legal despotism over education, our children now have the good fortune to be taught the noble ideas of the Romans. Then, liberty of labor? But that would mean competition, which in turn leaves production unconsumed, ruins businessmen, and exterminates the people. Perhaps liberty of trade? But everyone knows, and the advocates of protective tariffs have proved over and over again, that freedom of trade ruins every person who engages in it, and that it is necessary to suppress freedom of trade in order to prosper. Possibly, then, liberty of association. But according to socialist doctrine, true liberty and voluntary association are in contradiction to each other, and the purpose of the socialists is to suppress liberty of association precisely in order to force people to associate together in true liberty. Clearly, then, the conscience of the Social Democrats cannot permit persons to have any liberty because they believe that the nature of mankind tends always toward every kind of degradation and disaster. Thus, of course, the legislators must make plans for the people in order to save them from themselves. This line of reasoning brings us to a challenging question. If people are as incapable, as immoral, and as ignorant as the politicians indicate, then why is the right of these same people to vote defended with such passionate insistence? The claims of these organizers of humanity raise another question, which I have often asked them, and which, so far as I know, they have never answered. If the natural tendencies of mankind are so bad that it is not safe to permit people to be free, how is it that the tendencies of these organizers are always good? Do not the legislators and their appointed agents also belong to the human race? Or do they believe that they themselves are made of a finer clay than the rest of mankind? The organizers maintain that society, when left undirected, rushes headlong to its inevitable destruction because the instincts of the people are so perverse. The legislators claim to stop this suicidal course and to give it a saner direction. Apparently, then, the legislators and the organizers have received from heaven an intelligence and virtue that place them beyond and above mankind. If so, let them show their titles to this superiority. They would be the shepherds over us, their sheep. Certainly, such an arrangement presupposes that they are naturally superior to the rest of us. And certainly, we are fully justified in demanding from the legislators and organizers proof of this natural superiority. Please understand that I do not dispute their right to invent social combinations, to advertise them, to advocate them, and to try them upon themselves at their own expense and risk. But I do dispute their right to impose these plans upon us by law, by force, and to compel us to pay for them with our taxes. I do not insist that the supporters of these various social schools of thought, the Proudhonists, the Cabetists, the Fourierists, the Universitarists, and the Protectionists, renounce their various ideas. I insist only that they renounce this one idea they have in common. They need only to give up the idea of forcing us to acquiesce to their groups and series, their socialized projects, their free credit banks, their Greco-Roman concept of morality, and their commercial regulations. I ask only that we be permitted to decide upon these plans for ourselves, that we not be forced to accept them, directly or indirectly, if we find them to be contrary to our best interests or repugnant to our consciences. But these organizers desire access to the tax funds and to the power of the law in order to carry out their plans. In addition to being oppressive and unjust, this desire also implies the fatal supposition that the organizer is infallible and mankind is incompetent. But again, if persons are incompetent to judge for themselves, then why all this talk about universal suffrage? This contradiction in ideas is, unfortunately but logically, reflected in events in France. For example, Frenchmen have led all other Europeans in obtaining their rights, or more accurately, their political demands. Yet this fact has in no respect prevented us from becoming the most governed, the most regulated, the most imposed upon, the most harnessed, and the most exploited people in Europe. France also leads all other nations as the one where revolutions are constantly to be anticipated. And under the circumstances, it is quite natural that this should be the case. And this will remain the case so long as our politicians continue to accept this idea that has been so well expressed by Monsieur Louis Blanc. Society receives its momentum from power. This will remain the case so long as human beings with feelings continue to remain passive, so long as they consider themselves incapable of bettering their prosperity and happiness by their own intelligence and their own energy, so long as they expect everything from the law. In short, so long as they imagine that their relationship to the state is the same as that of the sheep to the shepherd. As long as these ideas prevail, it is clear that the responsibility of government is enormous. Good fortune and bad fortune, wealth and destitution, equality and inequality, virtue and vice, all then depend upon political administration. It is burdened with everything, it undertakes everything, it does everything, therefore it is responsible for everything. If we are fortunate, then government has a claim to our gratitude. But if we are unfortunate, then government must bear the blame. For are not our persons and property now at the disposal of government? Is not the law omnipotent? In creating a monopoly of education, the government must answer to the hopes of the fathers of families who have thus been deprived of their liberty. And if these hopes are shattered, whose fault is it? In regulating industry, the government has contracted to make it prosper. Otherwise, it is absurd to deprive industry of its liberty. And if industry now suffers, whose fault is it? In meddling with the balance of trade by playing with tariffs, the government thereby contracts to make trade prosper. And if this results in destruction instead of prosperity, whose fault is it? In giving the maritime industries protection in exchange for their liberty, the government undertakes to make them profitable. And if they become a burden to the taxpayers, whose fault is it? Thus there is not a grievance in the nation for which the government does not voluntarily make itself responsible. Is it surprising, then, that every failure increases the threat of another revolution in France? And what remedy is proposed for this? To extend indefinitely the domain of the law, that is, the responsibility of government. But if the government undertakes to control and to raise wages and cannot do it, if the government undertakes to care for all who may be in want and cannot do it, if the government undertakes to support all unemployed workers and cannot do it, if the government undertakes to lend interest-free money to all borrowers and cannot do it, if, in these words that we regret to say escaped from the pen of Monsieur de Lamartine, the state considers that its purpose is to enlighten, to develop, to enlarge, to strengthen, to spiritualize, and to sanctify the soul of the people. And if the government cannot do all of these things, what then? Is it not certain that after every government failure, which, alas, is more than probable, there will be an equally inevitable revolution? Now, let us return to a subject that was briefly discussed in the opening pages of this thesis, the relationship of economics and of politics, political economy. A science of economics must be developed before a science of politics can be logically formulated. Essentially, economics is the science of determining whether the interests of human beings are harmonious or antagonistic. This must be known before a science of politics can be formulated to determine the proper functions of government. immediately following the development of a science of economics, and at the very beginning of the formulation of a science of politics, this all-important question must be answered. What is law? What ought it to be? What is its scope, its limits? Logically, at what point do the just powers of the legislator stop? I do not hesitate to answer. Law is the common force organized to act as an obstacle to injustice. In short, law is justice. It is not true that the legislator has absolute power over our persons and liberty. The existence of persons and property preceded the existence of the legislator, and his function is only to guarantee their safety. It is not true that the function of law is to regulate our consciences, our ideas, our wills, our education, our opinions, our work, our trade, our talents, or our pleasures. The function of law is to protect the free exercise of these rights and to prevent any person from interfering with the free exercise of these same rights by any other person. Since law necessarily requires the support of force, its lawful domain is only in the areas where the use of force is necessary. This is justice. Every individual has the right to use force for lawful self-defense. It is for this reason that the collective force, which is only the organized combination of the individual forces, may lawfully be used for the same purpose, and it cannot be used legitimately for any other purpose. Law is solely the organization of the individual right of self-defense, which existed before law was formalized. Law is justice. The mission of the law is not to oppress persons and plunder them of their property, even though the law may be acting in a philanthropic spirit. Its mission is to protect persons and property. Furthermore, it must not be said that the law may be philanthropic if, in the process, it refrains from oppressing persons and plundering them of their property. This would be a contradiction. The law cannot avoid having an effect upon persons and property, and if the law acts in any manner except to protect them, its actions then necessarily violate the liberty of persons and their right to own property. The law is justice, simple and clear, precise and bounded. Every eye can see it, and every mind can grasp it. For justice is measurable, immutable, and unchangeable. Justice is neither more than this, nor less than this. If you exceed this proper limit, if you attempt to make the law religious, fraternal, equalizing, philanthropic, industrial, literary, or artistic, you will then be lost in an uncharted territory, in vagueness and uncertainty, in a forced utopia, or even worse, in a multitude of utopias, each striving to seize the law and impose it upon you. This is true because fraternity and philanthropy, unlike justice, do not have precise limits. Once started, where will you stop? And where will the law stop itself? Monsieur de Saint-Cricq would extend his philanthropy only to some of the industrial groups. He would demand that the law control the consumers to benefit the producers. Monsieur Considerant would sponsor the cause of the labor groups. He would use the law to secure for them a guaranteed minimum of clothing, housing, food, and all other necessities of life. Monsieur Louis Blanc would say, and with reason, that these minimum guarantees are merely the beginning of complete fraternity. He would say that the law should give tools of production and free education to all working people. Another person would observe that this arrangement would still leave room for inequality. He would claim that the law should give to everyone, even in the most inaccessible hamlet, luxury, literature, and art. All of these proposals are the high road to communism. Legislation will be then, in fact, already is, the battlefield for the fantasies and greed of everyone. Law is justice. In this proposition, a simple and enduring government can be conceived. And I defy anyone to say how even the thought of revolution, of insurrection, of the slightest uprising could arise against a government whose organized force was confined only to suppressing injustice. Under such a regime, there would be the most prosperity, and it would be the most equally distributed. As for the sufferings that are inseparable from humanity, none would even think of blaming the government for them. This is true because if the force of government were limited to suppressing injustice, then government would be as innocent of these sufferings as it is now innocent of changes in the temperature. As proof of this statement, consider this question. Have the people ever been known to rise against the Court of Appeals, or mob a justice of the peace in order to get higher wages, free credit, tools of production, favorable tariffs, or government-created jobs? Everyone knows perfectly well that such matters are not within the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals or a justice of the peace. And if government were limited to its proper functions, everyone would soon learn that these matters are not within the jurisdiction of the law itself. But make the laws upon the principle of fraternity. Proclaim that all good and all bad stem from the law, that the law is responsible for all individual misfortunes and all social inequalities. Then the door is open to an endless succession of complaints, irritations, troubles, and revolutions. Law is justice, and it would indeed be strange if law could properly be anything else. Is not justice right? Are not rights equal? By what right does the law force me to conform to the social plans of Monsieur Memorel, Monsieur de Melun, Monsieur Thiers, or Monsieur Louis Blanc? If the law has a moral right to do this, why does it not then force these gentlemen to submit to my plans? Is it logical to suppose that nature has not given me sufficient imagination to dream up a utopia also? Should the law choose one fantasy among many and put the organized force of government at its service only? Law is justice, and let it not be said, as it continually is said, that under this concept the law would be atheistic, individualistic, and heartless, that it would make mankind in its own image. This is an absurd conclusion, worthy only of those worshippers of government who believe that the law is mankind. Nonsense! Do these worshippers of government believe that free persons will cease to act? Does it follow that if we receive no energy from the law, we shall receive no energy at all? Does it follow that if the law is restricted to the function of protecting the free use of our faculties, we will be unable to use our faculties? Suppose that the law does not force us to follow certain forms of religion, or systems of association, or methods of education, or regulations of labor, or regulations of trade, or plans for charity. Does it then follow that we shall eagerly plunge into atheism, hermitry, ignorance, misery, and greed? If we are free, does it follow that we shall no longer recognize the power and goodness of God? Does it follow that we shall then cease to associate with each other, to help each other, to love and succor our unfortunate brothers, to study the secrets of nature, and to strive to improve ourselves to the best of our abilities? Law is justice, and it is under the law of justice, under the reign of right, under the influence of liberty, safety, stability, and responsibility, that every person will attain his real worth and the true dignity of his being. It is only under this law of justice that mankind will achieve slowly, no doubt, but certainly, God's design for the orderly and peaceful progress of humanity. It seems to me that this is theoretically right. For whatever the question under discussion, whether religious, philosophical, political, or economic, whether it concerns prosperity, morality, equality, right, justice, progress, responsibility, cooperation, property, labor, trade, capital, wages, taxes, population, finance, or government. At whatever point on the scientific horizon I begin my researches, I invariably reach this one conclusion. The solution to the problems of human relationships is to be found in liberty. And does not experience prove this? Look at the entire world. Which countries contain the most peaceful, the most moral, and the happiest people? Those people are found in the countries where the law least interferes with private affairs, where government is least felt, where the individual has the greatest scope, and free opinion the greatest influence, where administrative powers are fewest and simplest, where taxes are lightest and most nearly equal, and popular discontent the least excited and the least justifiable, where individuals and groups most actively assume their responsibilities, and consequently, where the morals of admittedly imperfect human beings are constantly improving, where trade, assemblies, and associations are the least restricted, where labor, capital, and populations suffer the fewest forced displacements, where mankind most nearly follows its own natural inclinations, where the inventions of men are most nearly in harmony with the laws of God. In short, the happiest, most moral, and most peaceful people are those who most nearly follow this principle. Although mankind is not perfect, still all hope rests upon the free and voluntary actions of persons within the limits of right. Law or force is to be used for nothing except the administration of universal justice. This must be said. There are too many great men in the world, legislators, organizers, do-gooders, leaders of the people, fathers of nations, and so on and so on. Too many persons place themselves above mankind. They make a career of organizing it, patronizing it, and ruling it. Now, someone will say, you yourself are doing this very thing. True, but it must be admitted that I act in an entirely different sense. If I have joined the ranks of the reformers, it is solely for the purpose of persuading them to leave people alone. I do not look upon people as Vacasan looked upon his automaton. Rather, just as the physiologist accepts the human body as it is, so do I accept people as they are. I desire only to study and admire. My attitude toward all other persons is well illustrated by this story from a celebrated traveler. He arrived one day in the midst of a tribe of savages, where a child had just been born. A crowd of soothsayers, magicians, and quacks, armed with rings, hooks, and cords, surrounded it. One said, "This child will never smell the perfume of a peace pipe unless I stretch his nostrils." Another said, "He will never be able to hear unless I draw his earlobes down to his shoulders." A third said, "He will never see the sunshine unless I slant his eyes." Another said, "He will never stand upright unless I bend his legs." A fifth said, "He will never learn to think unless I flatten his skull." "Stop," cried the traveler. "What God does is well done. Do not claim to know more than he. God has given organs to this frail creature. Let them develop and grow strong by exercise, use, experience, and liberty. God has given to men all that is necessary for them to accomplish their destinies. He has provided a social form as well as a human form, and these social organs of persons are so constituted that they will develop themselves harmoniously in the clean air of liberty. Away, then, with quacks and organizers. Away with their rings, chains, hooks, and pincers. Away with their artificial systems. Away with the whims of governmental administrators, their socialized projects, their centralization, their tariffs, their government schools, their state religions, their free credit, their bank monopolies, their regulations, their restrictions, their equalization by taxation, and their pious moralizations. Yet now that the legislators and do-gooders have so futilely inflicted so many systems upon society, may they finally end where they should have begun. May they reject all systems and try liberty. For liberty is an acknowledgement of faith in God and His works. We hope you've enjoyed our audiobook. Please take the time to visit freeaudio.org, download some audiobooks, and please feel free to make a donation. We appreciate your support. Thank you. This is Marvin Payne, your host.